Today's episode will touch on sensitive topics such as drug addiction and drug overdose, pregnancy loss, suicide, and self-harm. So if you are sensitive to this content, please listen at your own discretion. What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hello and welcome to Art Muse, a podcast that aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret well-known works of art by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. While these women's faces are familiar to viewers around the world, their identities have been largely forgotten. Together, we will explore the important lives and legacy of the female muse and appreciate these works of art from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Is the muse in actuality just as, if not more, important than the artists themselves? And I'm your host, Grace Anna. We know what we are, but we know not what we may be. These famous words are spoken by Ophelia in Act 4, Scene 5 of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Two scenes later, Ophelia would drown herself in a river nearby, swallowed by heartbreak and betrayal. The most famous depiction of Shakespeare's fallen heroine is, of course, Sir John Everett Millais's Ophelia. We see Ophelia moments after her last breath, floating in a river of flowers and moss. It has become one of the world's most renowned paintings, a reminder of the fragility of life, a shared moment of grief that we all feel as we look into Ophelia's lifeless eyes. Much like Ophelia, who upon speaking these famous lines did not foresee her soon-to-be tragic ending, the model in Millais' rendition of Shakespeare's fallen heroine would not have known of her own devastating end, and of the legend that her life would one day become. Listeners, today I introduce you to Elizabeth Siddal, the real-life Ophelia, a 19th-century English artist, poet, model, and the heart and soul of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. Her life story has been lost in a muddle of myth and fantasy. It's hard to differentiate between the legend of Elizabeth Siddal and the real Elizabeth Siddal. Few females of her time have sparked as much popular imagination. She has been the subject of novels, films, television programs, and urban legends passed down for over a century. She is eroticized and romanticized as a beautiful and tragic figure who, like Ophelia, met her end far too early, a damsel in distress who cannot be saved from her own destruction. She is often discussed in relation to the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood as the face of the movement and the wife of the group's core member, Gabriel Dante Rossetti. The story so often places Elizabeth Siddal in a subordinate position as a wondrous creature. Yes, they literally use the word creature that the group one day discovered as the victim of a decade-long tumultuous love affair with Rossetti, and as a fragile and delicate woman whose health was often in a precarious state. But what is so wrongfully left out of the story is that Elizabeth Siddal was an artist and poet in her own right, who produced over 100 original works, that she was the only woman to exhibit her work alongside the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, and whose work was so impressive that it was acquired by an American collector. And despite having no formal education in the arts, she secured her own patron who proclaimed her an artistic genius. In today's episode, I aim to honor Elizabeth Siddal as the woman she knew herself to be, not the mythologized version that has kept her glory in the shadows for far too long. So let's begin. Elizabeth Eleanor Siddal was born on July 25, 1829. She was named after her mother, Elizabeth Eleanor Evans, who was of Welsh origins. On her father's side, she came from a long line of craftsmen. Her grandfather was a scissor maker, and her father, Charles Siddle, ran a cutlery business. Though her father was not wealthy, the Siddle family could be traced back to an aristocratic lineage from Derbyshire. Because of this, Charles was convinced that he was the rightful heir to 70 acres of farmland and spent much of his time trying to prove his claim. He squandered the majority of the family's earnings on a continued lawsuit, which he never won. As a result, the family was in a perpetual state of financial strain, and despite the success of his cutlery business, Charles could never elevate his family from the working class. While in a far from favorable financial situation, Elizabeth's family was not nearly as poor as many accounts make them out to be. Her exaggerated humble beginnings is one of many fictions that we will debunk that previously served to weaken Elizabeth's image. Elizabeth grew up in a thriving working-class community, quite an upgrade from some of London's roughest areas. She was taught prim manners, like how to eat and conduct herself in public, which was of utmost importance in Victorian England. While we do not have a record of how Elizabeth was educated, she was taught how to read and write, presumably by her parents. From an early age, Elizabeth showed a special interest in drawing and painting. And as legend goes, after discovering a Tennessee poem on a scrap of newspaper, Elizabeth developed a particular love for poetry. Sadly, her poetry and artwork do not exist from this time, but her early passion for the arts left an indelible impression that would continue to fuel her for the rest of her life. While the family's strained finances meant that Elizabeth and her 7 siblings had to find work as soon as they could, it may have also been her eye for aesthetics that led Elizabeth to working at a millinery shop. Millinery, or hat making, was an integral part of the fashion business, fashioning women's bonnets to fit the season's latest trends. We know that in 1849, at the age of 20, Elizabeth Siddle was working in a shop in central London. Working in a millinery shop was no walk in the park. Girls often began apprenticing as early as the age of 13. The working conditions were poor, working up to 12-hour days, especially during the high seasons. The conditions of the shop would have inevitably hardened Elizabeth, and she could not have been the innocent girl of urban legend. Instead, she would have had to show great resilience and determination to succeed in the millinery world. Elizabeth may have also been training in art school while working at the shop, suggesting that her desire to be an artist predated her induction into the Pre-Raphaelite group. While we do not know this for certain, it can be safely said that Elizabeth had an eye for the arts, and that she would have been more than ready for when the Pre-Raphaelites would enter her world. The Pre-Raphaelite movement was formed in London in 1848, by a group of young artists who established a new style of painting against the conventional academic style. These artists believed that art had taken a turn for the worse with the start of the Renaissance, specifically with the artist Raphael, and instead turned their focus to earlier times. They drew their subject matter from literature, especially fond of Shakespeare and poetry. The most important members were John Everett Millais, William Holman Hunt, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, and Walter Deverell. It is Walter Deverell to whom we owe the next part of our story, and it is Walter Deverell who was about to change Elizabeth Siddle's life forever. As legend goes, in the winter of 1849, Walter Deverell was taking his mother shopping along Cranbourne Street, when he spotted through the window a tall and slender woman with copper-colored hair and large green eyes. Elizabeth Siddle was far from a conventional beauty in Victorian England. Her body lacked the curves to give her a womanly physique, and her red hair was not only found to be unattractive, but was thought to be unlucky. In fact, red hair was victim to long-held superstitions, dating back as far as ancient Egypt, where redheads were burned alive. But it wasn't Elizabeth's physical attraction per se that lured Deverell in. At the time, Deverell was working on a painting titled Twelfth Night and was desperately searching for a woman with red hair to model as Viola. In the scene, Viola disguises herself as a page boy. So not only did Deverell need a redhead, but he specifically needed a woman whose body could pass as a boy's. And as Deverell spotted Elizabeth Siddle in the hat shop, he knew his prayers had at last been answered. Most versions of this tale usually claim it was Deverell's mother who first approached Elizabeth, since it would have been inappropriate for Deverell to approach her directly. As modeling was often linked to prostitution, these stories credit Deverell's mother with convincing Elizabeth, and eventually Elizabeth's mother, that her honor would remain intact. The language often robs Elizabeth of her own agency. She is referred to as a, quote, damsel that was, quote, discovered. A passive participant in one of the most important decisions of her life. She is often misidentified as a young girl of 16, as a way to make her seem more helpless, when in fact she was over 20, and actually a bit older than some of the members of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. Instead, we should consider that Elizabeth Siddle likely made an informed and empowered decision to pursue modeling when the opportunity presented itself to her. By sitting for an artist, she could earn more than double than she did at the millinery shop, for a job that was incrementally less physically taxing. And for someone with a propensity for creativity herself, the chance to work with artists must have seemed especially appealing. More recently, it has been suggested that Elizabeth showed her watercolors and drawings to the director of London School of Design, who was none other than Walter Deverell's father, and that this was actually how Elizabeth met Deverell. While we cannot say for sure, she certainly was no damsel, but rather a woman getting her first foot through the door of her artistic career. And so the first painting Elizabeth Siddle modeled for is Walter Deverell's Twelfth Night. Elizabeth poses as Viola, garbed in a brightly colored page's dress and tights. Her copper hair is pulled back. She leans forward as she looks to the character of Orsino, whom Deverell painted as himself. On the other side is the jester Festi, modeled by Gabriel Dante Rossetti. This figure was already painted prior to Elizabeth, and she would not have known that this jester would one day become her greatest source of love and despair. Walter Deverell quickly notified the other members of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood about Elizabeth. Holman Hunt recalled Deverell exclaiming, "You fellows can't tell what a stupendously beautiful creature I have found. By Jove, she is like a queen, magnificently tall, with a lovely figure, a stately neck, and a face of the most delicate and finished modeling. Tomorrow she is coming again. You two should come down and see her. She really is a wonder." You get a sense of the dehumanizing language used to describe Elizabeth as a creature and spectacle to be seen. You can also get a sense of why the other members of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood began clamoring for Elizabeth to model for them. And so Elizabeth quickly became the movement's most desired model. By the early 1850s, she had sat for most of the Pre-Raphaelite painters and modeled as a variety of characters. She held her poses well and embodied the spirit of the figure she posed for. She was well-versed in the painting's subject matter and characters, taking an active role and personal interest in the works she modeled for. And her talent was paying off. While she kept a part-time job at the millinery shop for security, she was earning double her usual rates modeling. Elizabeth was successfully turning modeling into a career. And more than the monetary gain, modeling was a new and exciting experience. As Elizabeth recalled, quote, "It was being in a new world to be with them. And a new and exciting world it was." Elizabeth was making her way into the heart of the burgeoning artistic community of London, a community she would have otherwise been left out of due to her gender and class. Was it the artist using Elizabeth as a model? Or was it really Elizabeth using the artist to carve a pathway towards a new life and artistic career? And it was at this exciting point that Elizabeth Siddal modeled for John Everett Millais in his now-famous Ophelia. Millais captured the moment that Ophelia, rejected by Hamlet and now mourning the death of her father, drowns herself in a river. It is a tragic painting of a life lost too soon, and of the ephemeral nature of youth. It's not just Millais' impeccable artistry, but also Elizabeth Siddal's presence that makes the painting as powerful as it is. Elizabeth was 23 years old when she posed as Ophelia. Millais' painting would become, inarguably, the most famous depiction of Elizabeth, and perhaps the best-known work to come out of the pre-Raphaelite brotherhood at large. Contemporaries noted that Ophelia was the most realistic representation of Elizabeth out of all the works she sat for. Elizabeth Siddal posed as Ophelia in a large bath filled with water, which was heated by lamps underneath. At one point, many hours into the session, the lamps went out. Unnoticed by Millais, who was deep in concentration, Elizabeth remained in the bath for several more hours while the water turned frigid. Elizabeth, not wanting to move and disrupt his artistic process, never notified Millais. The incident resulted in Elizabeth becoming severely ill, and while Elizabeth herself never complained, her father became furious that Millais had been so negligent and compromised her health. He threatened to sue Millais, but was eventually calmed down when Millais covered Elizabeth's medical bills. Though in the end Elizabeth recovered, the story accentuates her deep commitment, sacrificing her own health and in some ways her own life for the sake of art. And it is this commitment that gives the painting an eerie lifelikeness to it. The paleness of Ophelia's skin and lifelessness of her body become one with Elizabeth's own frozen body. What was Elizabeth thinking about as she laid still in the bath for so many hours on end? Soon after Elizabeth agreed to model as Ophelia, her elder brother Charles unexpectedly passed away. We can only imagine the anguish that Elizabeth was experiencing, and that this is what occupied her mind. She may have been consumed with thoughts of stolen youth and of the inexplicable cruelty of life, whispering Charles's name as she kept her body motionless. It is this sense of personal grief that we feel as we look into Ophelia's perished eyes. Ophelia's pain is Elizabeth's pain, her grief, Elizabeth's grief. Her loss, Elizabeth's loss. As we will see, Elizabeth Siddal and Ophelia's connection did not end with the completion of the painting, but Ophelia's story would mysteriously foreshadow Elizabeth's own untimely end, just 9 years later. Elizabeth could not have known at the time just how intertwined her own life would become with Shakespeare's fallen heroine. It was during the same pivotal time in Elizabeth's life that she and the pre-Raphaelite member Gabriel Dante Rossetti began to develop a romantic relationship. Their relationship was one of passion, but also one of frequent upheaval, what today we would call twin flames. It was the type of relationship that when things were good, they were amazing, and when things were rocky, they were utterly devastating. The drastic ups and downs of their relationship may have been due to Elizabeth and Rossetti's mutual tendency towards depression, mood swings, and addiction. The pair began to refer to themselves as Guggums, and Rossetti not only gave Elizabeth the nickname Lizzie, but convinced her to change the spelling of her last name to what he believed was a more sophisticated spelling. The nickname and name change was testament to Rossetti's controlling nature and his attempt to improve Elizabeth to his liking. Unfortunately, it is this spelling that most scholars still use, as well as the pet name Lizzie, a continued disservice to Elizabeth's integrity. As creatives, Elizabeth and Rossetti had a more mutually beneficial relationship. Once Rossetti started to paint Elizabeth, he quickly found that he could not stop. Rossetti's sister, Christina, once wrote, "One face looks out from all his canvases. A saint, an angel. Every canvas means the same one meaning. Neither more, neither less. He feeds upon her face by day and night, and she, with true kind eyes, looks back on him." Rossetti drew and painted Elizabeth over 1,000 times in the span of their decade-long relationship. Elizabeth became Rossetti's ultimate source of inspiration, and after some time, he was no longer willing to share her with other artists. By 1852, just a year after Ophelia was painted, Rossetti asked that Elizabeth model exclusively for him. It was the same year that Elizabeth terminated her part-time job at the millinery shop, perhaps also at Rossetti's request. Though this placed Elizabeth in an extremely vulnerable financial position, now almost completely dependent on Rossetti, Elizabeth wasn't as helpless as many make her out to be. During this time, Rossetti began to teach Elizabeth how to properly draw and paint, bolstering her natural artistic talent with trained skill. By 1852, Elizabeth was collaborating on works with Rossetti, as well as illustrating poems and creating her own paintings and drawings. We get a sense of this exciting period of artistic exploration from a drawing by Rossetti, made in the same year, in which we see Elizabeth deep in concentration, leaning over an easel painting. Elizabeth was working towards becoming an artist in her own right. This was no small feat in a world where both her gender and class would have made it almost impossible to do so. Elizabeth did not live in a time when women could become serious artists, and few were even educated in the arts. Her willingness to challenge the societal norms placed on women of her time deserves recognition. And as belittling as Rossetti could be, it seems that he actually took Elizabeth as an artist quite seriously and championed her work. Elizabeth began to develop her own artistic style, which was remarkably ahead of her time, looking forward to the work of Matisse half a century later. Many of her works depicted celebrated heroines from literature, women who stood in their power and embodied their own creative force. And because she did not have access to models, she became her own muse, painting herself on a number of occasions. Which brings us to one of the most captivating works by Elizabeth Siddal, her Self-Portrait of 1854. The portrait was painted while Rossetti was out of town, and Elizabeth found herself alone in his artist's studio. How did it feel as Elizabeth wandered the studio with no other artist to model for or no one to watch over her? We can only imagine how exhilarating this must have been for Elizabeth, who for perhaps the first time in her life was granted the freedom to create art completely on her own. As she picked up her brush, she was at liberty to be her own artist. And her portrait reflects this newfound confidence. She stares at the viewer with a serious expression, strong and uncompromising. Instead of romanticizing her own image, we see an honest and straightforward portrait, unafraid to depict herself in her natural form. This is in stark comparison to the idealized way in which the men of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood portrayed Elizabeth. The self-portrait is a rare opportunity for us to see Elizabeth as she saw herself. It is as if Elizabeth has taken this moment on her own to say, "This is me, and I'm an artist to be reckoned with." Rossetti wrote in a letter to a friend that Elizabeth, quote, "wishes that something should be done by her to make a beginning, to set her mind a little more at ease about her pursuit of art." And with Rossetti's help, this wish soon became a reality. In 1854, famed art critic John Ruskin was facing public humiliation when his wife, Effie, filed to annul their marriage due to the fact that it was never consummated. The subtext was, of course, that John Ruskin was sexually inadequate, and it turned him into the butt of jokes all over London. To make things worse, Effie had already moved on, falling deeply in love with none other than John Everett Millais, and married him within a year of their divorce. John Ruskin had hit rock bottom and was desperately seeking a new venture to redeem his reputation. And it is at this point that Rossetti made his move. In March of 1855, Rossetti set up a meeting with Ruskin and showed him all of Elizabeth's artworks. John Ruskin was so impressed that he bought every single one on the spot and declared Elizabeth a genius, far more talented than Rossetti himself. He was so entranced by Elizabeth's work that Ruskin proposed he be Elizabeth's patron, paying her an annual salary to support her work. Ruskin was the stepping stone that Elizabeth needed to make her break as an artist on her own, and thus was the start of Elizabeth's artistic career. While an incredible feat, the arrangement unfortunately did not respect Elizabeth as a sovereign individual, as much of the terms were agreed upon by Rossetti and Ruskin. It was Rossetti who dictated the prices of her work, as well as the annual remuneration for Ruskin's patronage. And, in fact, Elizabeth specifically requested that her work be sold individually instead of through a patronage to avoid turning over all of her work to one man. But Rossetti and Ruskin coerced her into accepting the offer. The deal meant that Elizabeth's work moving forward would be indebted to Ruskin rather than made for her own personal enjoyment and gain. As patron, Ruskin quickly tried to control other aspects of Elizabeth's life, especially her health. And soon after the deal was finalized, Ruskin encouraged Elizabeth to leave London for a health retreat. Elizabeth's poor health is a main point of focus in most of her biographies. But what is often not discussed is how Elizabeth's proclaimed medical conditions conveniently kept her in a vulnerable position. There are numerous reports of women in Victorian England diagnosed with, quote, weakness, which actually had more to do with social class than physical health. At the time, women of the lower classes were seen as hardy and strong, and therefore capable of hard labor, whereas women of the higher classes were seen as too delicate to work. Ladylike became synonymous with fragility. While this kept women of higher classes from doing manual labor, these often baseless diagnoses suppressed women's agency. Sadly, there is much irony to a diagnosis like weakness, as it often kept women in a perpetual weakened position. Examining surviving medical reports, experts cannot even conclusively say what Elizabeth's condition actually was, and she was never properly diagnosed in her lifetime. Her symptoms generally consisted of nausea, lack of appetite, breathlessness, and dizzy spells. It's possible that Elizabeth may have developed an eating disorder, which flared during particularly stressful periods of her life, or that she may have suffered from an undiagnosed digestive disorder. These symptoms could have also developed from usage of the drug laudanum, which, as we will see, Elizabeth eventually became heavily addicted to. That is all to say that there is no evidence that Elizabeth had any debilitating medical conditions, at least not prior to the development of her addiction. And in fact, most doctors during her lifetime chalked her condition up to psychological causes. The doctor on the retreat that Ruskin insisted Elizabeth go on stated, quote, "The leading cause of her illness was identified as mental power, long pent up and overtaxed." At other times, she was described as, quote, "sickly headstrong," as if her desire to act on her own accord was a sickness. It almost seems that Rossetti and Ruskin continuously attributed Elizabeth's emotional distress to illness whenever it was convenient for them to do so, and that illness was quickly becoming one of the conditions of her allowance from Ruskin. Was Elizabeth actually weak, or was that imposed upon her to put her in a weak position? Might the continued focus on Elizabeth's health have been a way to make her vulnerable and dependent upon the men grasping to control every aspect of her life? Or was her physical health self-inflicted, a psychological coping mechanism she turned to when she may have felt she had lost all control? Another major point of focus is Elizabeth's tormented relationship with Rossetti, specifically his refusal to marry her. Many scholars argue that withholding marriage was one of the many ways in which Rossetti mistreated Elizabeth. And that very well may be true. It is noteworthy that the couple was in a relationship for almost a decade before marrying. And there are some valid reasons as to why Rossetti may have been behind this. For one, Rossetti may have felt that his family would not approve of Elizabeth due to her lower class origins. He didn't even introduce Elizabeth to his mother until 4 years into their relationship. But most of all, Rossetti was notorious for being unfaithful, having numerous affairs during the course of their relationship, and may have wanted to maintain a sense of freedom in his sexual endeavors. But instead of assuming Elizabeth was at the whim of Rossetti, it's worth considering that Elizabeth may have had her own reasons to remain unmarried. Women's values were undergoing a significant transformation in mid-19th century England. And in fact, Elizabeth was associated with some of the biggest feminist figures of the time. Remember that health retreat that Ruskin insisted Elizabeth go on? Well, she ended up going on it with Bessie Parks and Barbara Bodichon, who were some of the most prominent feminists of the time. In the same year as the retreat, Barbara Bodichon published her influential work, A Brief Summary in Plain Language of the Most Important Laws Concerning Women. And the following year, Bessie Parks gathered signatures to support the Married Women's Property Bill. This bill would ensure that married women, quote, would no longer pass from the state of freedom into the condition of a slave by having to turn all of a woman's belongings, earnings, children, and even body over as her husband's property. Parks and Bodichon saw marriage as a form of licensed slavery. We can only imagine that in the weeks these three women spent together, they left an impression on Elizabeth, who not only likely signed their petition, but shared their same values. This is supported by a nickname that Rossetti at times called Elizabeth, Ida. Ida, a character from a Tennessee poem titled The Princess, is a heroine who rules over a feminist land, where women turn down marriage for the pursuit of art, science, and education. Is it possible that Elizabeth, for reasons of her own, may have wanted to remain unmarried, to preserve her sense of independence? If she were to marry Rossetti, she would have had to turn over her annual income from Ruskin, and she may have also turned over whatever remained of her personal freedom. Instead, may Elizabeth have preferred a relationship as lovers, two artists who could inspire each other's works? We see the same sense of personal integrity in other areas of Elizabeth's life. Despite the limiting conditions of her patronage, Elizabeth tried to make the most of her situation through little acts of rebellion. With her new money from Ruskin, the first thing Elizabeth bought was her own art material. We know despite efforts to stop her, Elizabeth dabbled in spiritualism and channeled the other side. As much as Ruskin and Rossetti tried to make Elizabeth more ladylike, she continued to wear clothes she herself made, flowing dresses instead of corsets. And she used her money to afford summer holidays, where she reportedly rode donkeys on the beach. In 1856, Ruskin once again insisted that Elizabeth leave London to improve her health, this time for the south of France. He pleaded that Elizabeth avoid Paris, which he worried may aggravate her condition. In an act of defiance, Elizabeth instead spent the next 6 weeks and every last penny she had on a Parisian adventure, during which time she was able to see herself in Millais' Ophelia, which was exhibited at the Exposition Universelle in Paris. The following year, back in London, Elizabeth finally had her breakthrough moment as an artist. On May 25, 1857, Elizabeth exhibited her work in public for the first time. Her work was included in a Pre-Raphaelite retrospective, the only woman to exhibit her work alongside the Brotherhood. She presented three watercolors, one of which was bought by a Harvard professor, making its way to America. This was a remarkable accomplishment, especially as women were rarely permitted to display their work to the public. Not only did Elizabeth exhibit her work alongside a group of male artists, but she managed to land her work in an international collection. How did Elizabeth feel to see her art side by side with the artist she began her career modeling for? How did it feel to be the only woman whose work was able to adorn the walls? We can only imagine how proud Elizabeth must have felt to finally show her artwork to the world. Soon after the success of the exhibition, Elizabeth decided to terminate her arrangement with Ruskin, giving up her annual allowance. Her departure from Ruskin was a major move towards independence and reveals the confidence she had in her ability to provide for herself. Using what she had saved, she traveled with her sister, eventually settling in Sheffield, where her father was born and many of her relatives still lived. Elizabeth spent time reconnecting with her father's family line. She also began to attend classes at the Sheffield School of Art, where she received formal training, as well as access to facilities she could use to make her art. Her time in Sheffield was a time full of drive and ambition, when Elizabeth was striking out on her own as an independent artist and woman. Unfortunately, this would be the last period of Elizabeth's life when she had such liberty, and her life would soon take a dark turn. Upon her return to London, Elizabeth and Rossetti seem to have had a massive falling out, and while the details remain unclear, they took an almost two-year break from each other. Whatever the circumstances were, Elizabeth was evidently very, very angry. We get the sense of Elizabeth's feelings towards Rossetti during this time from a poem titled Love and Hate that she wrote in 1858. The poem ends with the lines, "Great love I bore thee, now great hate sits firmly in its place. All changes pass me like a dream, I neither sing nor pray, and thou art like a poisonous tree that stole my life away." We can feel the immense emotional pain that Elizabeth was in the throes of while writing these lines. We can only imagine what Rossetti could have done to sever their relationship under such hostile terms. To make matters worse, Elizabeth's father, Charles, died just after her 30th birthday, leaving her family in a precarious financial state. And in her time of need, society turned its back on Elizabeth. In the mid-19th century, an unmarried woman in her 30s garnered no sympathy. With no family money to fall back on, and Rossetti dominating the artistic community, Elizabeth must have felt extremely alone. Grieving her father and recoiling from the betrayal of her lover, Elizabeth was not so different from Ophelia after all. With nowhere to turn, Elizabeth began heavily using the drug laudanum as a means of coping. Laudanum was a mixture of opium with alcohol, and while it may be hard to believe today, it was widely available and often prescribed for a variety of symptoms. Laudanum was used to treat depression, headaches, menstrual pain, stomach issues, and it was even given to babies to soothe teething. While Elizabeth may have taken laudanum through her adult life, her usage and dependence on laudanum as a form of self-medication really ramped up during this time, and she began to experience the vicious cycle of addiction. In 1860, while on a health retreat in Hastings, Elizabeth fell gravely ill with what we can presume was an overdose of laudanum. She experienced severe vomiting, unable to keep anything down to sustain her, and became so weak that she could barely move. When her family became convinced that she was going to die, they pleaded with Rossetti to come and say his goodbyes to Elizabeth, who came at once despite their falling out. Perhaps eaten by guilt for the way he had treated Elizabeth, or convinced that she truly was dying, Rossetti promised to marry Elizabeth if she were to recover, regardless of the fact that he was having known affairs just before his arrival. And perhaps Elizabeth's dance with death shifted her perspective too, because in her weakened state, she agreed. Rossetti began to plan a rushed wedding for May 11th, which would have been his 32nd birthday. But Elizabeth was too weak to stand. She eventually recovered enough to marry Rossetti on May 22nd at St. Clement's Church. No friends or family were present. Elizabeth was allegedly so weak that she had to be carried down the aisle. Elizabeth and Rossetti seemed to have a renewed commitment to each other. Elizabeth was well enough to honeymoon with Rossetti in France, where they spent time in Paris. The pair had a fun-filled time, and as legend goes, even befriended two stray dogs, which they took home with them. And for this short period of time, Elizabeth and Rossetti seemed to be genuinely happy. Upon their return to London, Elizabeth became pregnant with a baby girl. Despite her frail health, Elizabeth's pregnancy seemed surprisingly healthy. As time went on, Elizabeth must have become more and more confident that she and her baby would be okay. In the first 3 months when she experienced expected nausea, the doctors told her to take laudanum. Whether it was due to this or her general dependence on laudanum, in the last month of her pregnancy, Elizabeth sensed that something had gone terribly wrong. She no longer felt her baby girl moving inside of her. Given the time, there wasn't much a doctor could do to confirm the safety of a baby, and so Elizabeth had to wait until she gave a natural birth. What was Elizabeth feeling as she anxiously awaited her child's birth? Did she descend into despair, or did she remain hopeful that her baby might still be alive? Unfortunately, on May 2, 1861, Elizabeth gave birth to a stillborn child. Because her baby had died 3 weeks prior, poisons from the dead fetus began leaching into her system and caused ill side effects. But the physical repercussions were nothing in comparison to the psychological trauma that ensued. Elizabeth's mental health completely deteriorated. Friends visiting Elizabeth recalled her staring at the childless cradle in silence for hours. At other times, she cried with a wildness only a grieving mother could know. She completely stopped eating. Elizabeth became wholly immersed in her grief and would never recover from the pain of losing her child. Elizabeth turned more and more to laudanum to ease her grieving heart. Her behavior became erratic and showed signs of someone in the throes of serious addiction. Did Elizabeth know that the same drug soothing her was also what likely killed her child? Did it even matter anymore? On February 10, 1862, Elizabeth managed to go out to dinner with Rossetti and their friend. Rossetti noticed that she seemed particularly drowsy on their way to dinner, but was accustomed to Elizabeth taking laudanum before leaving the house. They had what seemed to be an enjoyable dinner and headed home around 8 p.m. Once Elizabeth got settled in bed, Rossetti left to work on his art and returned around 11:30 p.m. By the time he got back, Elizabeth was in an unconscious state. Rossetti tried desperately to wake her, but Elizabeth wouldn't budge. He screamed for his neighbor's help, who called for a doctor, but by the time the doctor arrived, Elizabeth was already in a coma. The doctor pumped Elizabeth's stomach to no avail, and Rossetti, in his desperation, called three more doctors to try to resuscitate Elizabeth, none of which had any success. Elizabeth's family arrived in the middle of the night, and her sister held her hand as Elizabeth endured her final hours. At 7:30 a.m. on February 11th, Elizabeth took her last breath and was pronounced dead by all four doctors present. Elizabeth was 32 years old. At the time of her death, Elizabeth was pregnant again. The doctors confirmed that Elizabeth had taken a fatal dose of laudanum. Whether it was intentional or not remains unclear. Rossetti remarked that Elizabeth did not show any signs of wanting to end her life. Instead, he believed that Elizabeth, quote, did not do it to injure herself, but to quiet her nerves. She could not have lived without laudanum. She could not sleep at times nor take food. It is possible that Elizabeth misjudged the amount she took before bed, wishing only to be able to sleep. Others believe that she died by suicide, willfully taking her final dosage to end her suffering. What was running through Elizabeth's mind as she got into bed that night and took her final dose? Did she know as she closed her eyes that she would never again open them? Much like Ophelia, Elizabeth had drowned in her own grief. Both Elizabeth and the character she so famously modeled for were victims of their tragic circumstances, and whether intentional or not, they died of a broken heart. Upon Rossetti's insistence, Elizabeth was buried in the Rossetti family grave in Highgate, away from her own family, despite the fact that Elizabeth never got along with the Rossettis. Just before her coffin closed, Rossetti famously placed a manuscript of his unpublished poems to lay rest with Elizabeth, claiming he would never again write poetry. Rossetti was allegedly haunted by the spirit of Elizabeth for years after her death. Unable to remain in the home they had shared, he moved around, but Elizabeth's ghost visited him every night, regardless of his location. While this may be true, it's also largely possible that Rossetti was experiencing crippling guilt for the way he had treated Elizabeth during her lifetime, for his inability to save her. Or maybe because deep down he was thankful to be free of their relationship. A few years after her death, Rossetti made his esteemed portrait of Elizabeth titled Beata Beatrice. It is easily Rossetti's most revered work and most famous portrait of Elizabeth. Elizabeth is seated with her palms crossed. Eyes closed, she faces up towards heaven, as an ethereal light washes over her. She is caught in a moment of surrender and bliss. Many believe that the painting is a portrait of Elizabeth in the moment of death. Others believe that Rossetti has portrayed Elizabeth as she experiences the effects of laudanum, perhaps an imaginative moment of her last few hours after taking her final dosage. This is supported by the inclusion of a white poppy flower above her wrist, which is, of course, used to make opium. While the portrait became a public statement on Rossetti's grief and deep respect for his late wife, his private actions painted a very different picture. Remember that collection of unpublished poems that Rossetti buried with Elizabeth? Yeah, well, 7 years after her death, Rossetti decided he wanted the poems back so that he could publish them. Rossetti secretly arranged for Elizabeth's coffin to be unearthed from the ground so that his poems could be retrieved. Too ashamed to go himself, Rossetti sent his agent to oversee the exhumation. As legend goes, his agent, upon opening Elizabeth's coffin, found her body to be perfectly preserved and that her hair, still growing, had filled the entire coffin. While scientifically impossible, the story is one of many that lend to the now mythologized version of Elizabeth Siddle. Though she died in relative obscurity, by the 1880s, the legend of Elizabeth Siddle had taken full force. In the decades that followed, there was a growing obsession over Elizabeth, and many male artists fantasized about her, including Oscar Wilde. There was such a frenzy around her that J. Pierpont Morgan purchased the only existing photograph of Elizabeth, which he set in a gold and jeweled frame. While in life she so bravely fought to be remembered as an artist, in death, Elizabeth became almost exclusively known for her beauty, an unattainable and idealized femme fatale with an almost otherworldly presence. Her life story became a void in which men could project their fantasies onto, and the real Elizabeth Siddal was buried in myth. How can we change Elizabeth Siddal's narrative from one of tragedy to one of empowerment? How can we view her as an individual creative being, not just as a muse for the men who were lucky enough to paint her? How can we reclaim Elizabeth Siddal as the protagonist of her own story? My hope is that today's episode can be one of many tributes in which Elizabeth Siddal is remembered in the way that she deserves. The next time you see the drowned figure of Ophelia, think of Elizabeth, not as an ill-fated figure, but as a brave and creative woman who, against all odds, used her career as a model to carve her own path as an independent artist. Think of Elizabeth's strong spirit, her small but mighty acts of defiance, and the agency she took over her own life wherever possible. What if Elizabeth and the character of Ophelia were not tragic figures after all, but two free-spirited women who did the best they could within the limited worlds in which they lived? We end today's episode in the best way we can honor Elizabeth Siddal authentically, through her own words. Written shortly before her death, I share with you Elizabeth Siddal's poem, Lord, May I Come. Life and death are falling from me. Death are opening on me. Wherever my footsteps come and go, life is a stony way of woe. Lord, have I longed to go. Hollow hearts are ever near me. Soulless eyes have ceased to cheer me. Lord, may I come to thee. Life and youth and summer weather, to my heart no joy can gather. Lord, lift me from life's stony way. Loved eyes long closed in death watch for me. Holy death is waiting for me. Lord, may I come today. My outward life feels sad and still, like lilies in a frozen rill. I am gazing upwards to the sun, Lord, Lord, remembering my lost one. O Lord, remember me. How is it in the unknown land? Do the dead wander hand in hand? Give me trust in thee. Do we clasp dead hands and quiver with an endless joy forever? Good be unto thee. Is the air filled with wail of spirits circling round and round? Is the air filled with harp to fasten our angels' wings upon? Are there lakes of endless song to rest our tired eyes upon? Do tall white angels gaze and wend along the banks where lilies bend? Lord, we know not how this may be. Good Lord, we put our faith in thee. O God, remember me. I hope you enjoyed this episode on Elizabeth Siddal. I have included images, resources, and suggestions for further reading on the Art Muse website and Instagram. Art Muse is produced by Kula Production Company. Today's episode was written by me, your host, Grace Anna. Stay tuned as I continue to share the stories of the women behind some of the world's most important works of art. Until next time, bye for now.